good morning. I'd like to join Gary in saying welcome to all of you that are here with us today. And I'm glad you decided to still join us, even though Greg's not here. Probably because you didn't know, I'm guessing. That's what my mom told me. Can you believe that? Or something like that. I was close, right? That's close to, yeah. Anyway, it's good to see all of you. And thanks for coming out. I want to think with you just a little bit this morning. I want to start, though, by sharing a story with you. And I'll be honest, I debated and thought about how to share this. I even consulted my favorite sermon storyteller, John Watts. You guys remember him. I saw him in Tampa last week, and it was great to see him. And I was sort of getting his advice on this. And finally, I just said, you know what? I'm just going to tell you guys the story, the way it unfolded. And you don't know the people involved. I'm certain of that. And I'm going to anonymize it. But this is how it happened. It was about a year ago that I got a reply to an email that I had sent a brother. And periodically, what I would do is, I might see a post that maybe his wife would put on Facebook or something would trigger a thought. And I would remember this fellow that I had known and worshiped with some time ago. And so I would just periodically, I don't know, do you guys do that? I just shoot him a note and say, hey, how are you guys doing? And, you know, I hadn't seen him in person probably for 15 or 20 years, but every so often I would think about him. So I got a reply a number of months after I had sent him that note, and he said, sorry for the delay in my response. So far, we're all still alive through the pandemic. I think that's one of the things I was sort of wondering is how they had, you know, done during the pandemic. He said, I hope all is well with you and your family. And so it was nice to hear from him, even though it's a short note, just staying in contact with people. One of the things I love about moving is you sort of develop friendships, relationships, and know brothers and sisters in Christ all over the country, all over the world, and it's just a blessing. But about 7 months later, I got another email from him, and he said, good morning, Brent. Previously, I told you that everything was good, and thanks for contacting me. The truth is, and I'll call her Judy, the truth is Judy's divorcing me. I'm struggling mentally. Perhaps the worst it's ever been for me, not to be living with my family. I'm at a loss as to what to do in life. I'm struggling daily because I'm not with my family. My family has been everything I've ever lived for. I don't quite understand why we're divorcing. There hasn't been any adultery or anything of that nature. He said, I've not been at church in a very long time. I kind of feel like God has let me down, as much as I know that I'm wrong to think of it that way. He said, perhaps you could pray for us, and specifically that Judy and I will reconcile. He said, I'm at my wit's end and very despondent right now. I struggle with this every day and wonder where my life's going. I thought it might help me to open up to a brother. Forgive me for not having been upfront with you previously. I felt like it was my problem to deal with and embarrassed at the same time to tell you the truth of the matter. Again, thank you for reaching out to me previously. And perhaps you can pray for us, your brother Jack. I want you to imagine getting that. You know, we had worshiped with this family on a regular basis when we lived in another part of the country. It was a husband and wife, and they were babes in Christ when I came to know them. We both had young families at the time. Our kids played together, and it was probably some 20 years ago. And then we moved to another area, and we're not in frequent contact with them. But I was aware that they had made a big decision. They had decided to move to another part of the country. And you know why they decided to do that? I should have brought my little trick. I have a trick that I use to stop from getting emotional sometimes, but I forgot my trick. I didn't think I was going to get quite as emotional with this. But they did it because they wanted their children to grow up around more Christians and the children of Christians so that they would have more godly influences. I remember him saying to me on one occasion, he said, we moved for God. They were dedicated Christians. And They left their home, they left their extended family, and moved to a place where they thought they could have more godly influences surrounding their children. And so as you can probably tell, when I heard about this circumstance, it was crushing. And it was crushing for me being at quite some distance from the circumstances. And I can't imagine what it was like for this individual, the two of them going through what they were going through, as well as their family. So what do you do? What do you do in a case like that? I won't go into all the details, but I'll just tell you there's a sense of it's very challenging to try to fix so many things that seem to have developed over such a long period of time. And I kept asking myself from when I knew him how they had arrived at this point. I kept trying to ask, how could this have happened? And it turns out after they moved to the new location, they immediately joined themselves with a local church. Frankly, I don't know how well they integrated, and I'll tell you why. They talked different. They were from another part of the country, and they just sounded like foreigners probably to most people. And they probably had different habits and behaviors. And I'll just say that I think in a lot of our churches, things are so homogenous and uniform that sometimes we don't make room for the folks that are a little bit different. They certainly would have seemed like outsiders in many respects, I think. And then what was more, and I didn't really have firsthand experience with this, but they had a disabled child. I knew that they had a disabled child, but apparently as he got older, and he was nonverbal, but he would, you know, periodically let out various sounds and so forth. And so they were conscientious. And during worship, one of them would take their son out of the building, either during worship, during the Lord's Supper. And I think as a result, they also weren't able to attend classes on a regular basis. And after a while, it got to the point where one of them would just stay home with the child and the other would go to worship. And then they said, you know what? We hate worship, not worshiping together. And so they tried to worship together in their home. And then one of the other children realized if he sort of picked at his sister that everything could blow up and they could stop, you know. It was sort of like, you know, and so they would just give up. And so after a while, they even stopped their at-home worship. Until by the time I heard this story, they hadn't been going to church for many years. Probably like 4 years or longer. It reminded me of this idea of a slow, gradual departure. Each step, I think they could probably rationalize. They perhaps even felt it was necessary. And I think because I was only looking at this from a distance, that I was able to see something that I might not have been able to see if I were up close. And that is the need for compassion in the church toward our brothers and sisters who are on, maybe on the fringes, maybe aren't fully integrated into the group, maybe seem like outsiders in some way. And I kept wondering what could have happened differently. What if someone had relieved them a time or two during worship? I actually thought about a few of our ladies who likely would have swept in and said, hey, let me take him today so you guys can stay here together. What if someone had coached them, perhaps, or provided them help in managing their special needs child? What if someone had maybe not let them slip away ever so slowly and just held on to them? So many what ifs. What if someone had had compassion on them in their circumstances and offered a helping hand? Could we have had a different ending? And maybe we haven't seen the final ending, but could there have been an alternate ending for this story about Jack and Judy? So today we're going to talk about compassion. And I want us to see the degree to which Jesus modeled it in his life and taught it in his sermons. And you can see it throughout the epistles. You'll thank me later because I had a whole section on the compassion in the epistles. I had to cut it last night. So... but I want us to see, and here's the deal for us. Do we want to be like Jesus? Do we? Because if you do, you're going to exhibit a spirit of compassion, period. Do you want to be like Jesus, or is that just something we say? Do we really want to? You know, the word most often translated compassion is, I'm going to try to say this, and you guys can help me, splachnizomai. And that's the word. And I found it interesting because it literally means to be moved as to one's inwards, or to feel deeply or viscerally. You know, that idea of feeling viscerally is the word splank is the Greek word they use for guts. It's like to feel it in your guts. The first century Jews often located the deepest physical core of your emotions down in your guts. That's how they thought about their deepest feelings, where they thought about their deepest feelings arising. And so that's the word that's most often translated compassion, although there's a number of other words that we'll talk about as well. But here's the question I just want us to ask ourselves, and I want us to try to be as reflective as we possibly can. And I will say this, I think in so many ways, I think the group here does a really great job, but I think there's areas where we still can improve. I'm pretty sure of that, and I hope that we can touch on those. I don't want to pretend like, I think we have a very compassionate group in many ways, in some respects, and in others, I think we have plenty of room for growth and that we can continue to grow to be more like Jesus. So how well have Christians done at being compassionate? How well have the Christians with whom we have the closest fellowship done in being compassionate? And then how well have we done personally in being compassionate? You know, I think sometimes I think about myself and I don't think I've done that well. I'm an engineer. You know, engineers think about logic and reason, rationality. This word and this emotion is about feeling. It's not about logic and reason, rationality. And so I'm not sure that I've done all that well. And so I thought I would study it. I thought I would challenge myself, and I thought I would share it with you. Our objective is to be more like Jesus. So I want us to look through a number of passages in the New Testament and look at Jesus's example of compassion. To whom did he show it? To whom did he show compassion? How did he feel it? What did it result in? And then some other observations about this. So let's look at a few passages here. You know, as Jesus' ministry was beginning, we read in Mark 1, verse 4, starting in verse 40, that a leper came to him, imploring him, "Make me clean." And Jesus was moved with compassion and healed the leper. You know, it's interesting that this is certainly an individual that's on the outside, right? This is someone that was literally an outcast. How could this help Jesus? How could it advance his cause? Was not Jesus' consideration, right? Jesus felt compassion towards this leper, and he chose to cleanse him. In Mark chapter 5, you'll recall when Jesus and his disciples crossed the Sea of Galilee and came to the country of the Gadarenes, that he encountered a demon-possessed man wandering in the mountains and tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stone. And then after casting the demon out, notice what said. It said, he who had been demon-possessed begged him that he might be with him. However, Jesus did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you, and how he has had compassion on you." You know, this is someone that everybody else would avoid, right? This was not somebody that people wanted to be associated with. And did he deserve the compassion by our way of thinking? You know, probably by our way of thinking, we would maybe know. But Jesus showed him compassion as well. And he healed that demon-possessed man. You know, after passing through Capernaum, where he healed the centurion's son, he enters the town of Nain, south of Nazareth. As recorded in Luke 7, he came near to the gate of the city, and behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a large crowd from the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." And then he came and touched the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still, and he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." So he who was dead sat up and began to speak, and he presented him to his mother. Imagine how she felt at that moment. Compassion for those who were mourning the loss of loved ones is another example that we see from Jesus. Just before calling, empowering, and sending out the 12 disciples to heal sicknesses and disease, it's recorded in Matthew chapter 9 that Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion. Remember, this is a feeling that starts in the gut. He was moved with compassion for them because they were weary and scattered, like sheep having no shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." So he sees this multitude. He sees them as sheep with no shepherd, weary and scattered, and he has compassion on him. Do we know people that are weary, people that are scattered, people that may seem like sheep without a shepherd? And do we have compassion on them? You know, it wasn't but just after Jesus, John the Baptist was beheaded that we read in Matthew chapter 14 that Jesus heard it, and then he departed by boat to a deserted place by himself. You know, I think he wanted to be alone. I think he needed time to mourn and grieve the loss of John. But the multitudes followed him, we read. And when he went out and saw the great multitude, he was moved with compassion for them. And he healed their sick, and he fed about 5,000 men besides women and children. So even during this incredibly tough time where he wanted to mourn, grieve, and be alone, he sees the multitude and he has compassion on them. In another account of the feeding of the 5,000, we read, "And Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them because they were like sheep not having a shepherd." And what knows what he did in this case? It says, "And he began to teach them." You know, earlier we saw that when he saw them as sheep without shepherd, it uses the description of they were scattered and weary, perhaps directionless here in need of teaching, or perhaps because the predators, you know, the sheep needed to be protected, they needed the teaching as well. And so one of the things he did in his having of compassion was teach the people. And then Jesus heard, as Jesus heads to the region of Tyre and Sidon in Matthew 15, he continues healing. And in 15:29, Matthew 15, chapter 15 and verse 29, we read that Jesus departed from there. He skirted the Sea of Galilee and went up to the mountain and sat down there. And then great multitudes came to him, having with them the lame, the blind, the mute, the maimed, and many others. And they laid them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. So the multitude marveled when they saw the mute speaking, the maimed made whole, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. And Jesus says to his disciples, "I have compassion on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat." So this multitude had all sorts of people with him, and Jesus had compassion on him. And when you read that list of the people, do those seem like the people that often would be outcast, they would be on the outside, maybe rejected by many, and yet Jesus felt compassion for them. And then even as his death was drawing near and his disciples wanted to quiet the people, Jesus, upon hearing two blind men calling out, said, "Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." What does Jesus do? He stands still, calls them, and asks them what they want. And it's recorded that Jesus had compassion and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight, and they followed him. Imagine, he's busy, he has a schedule he's trying to keep, and yet he stops and he has compassion on these individuals. So let's just make a few observations from all of these examples of Jesus. First of all, and this is interesting to me, I don't think I realized this before I started studying, but did you know this is the emotion that Jesus is said to feel more than any other in the Gospels? Does that not strike you? Of all the emotions you can imagine us having, or Jesus having, this is the emotion that he's said to have more than any other. This splachnizomai, that Jesus felt so often was an emotional reaction that he felt in his gut as he observed other people's suffering. His guts twisted for hungry people, for sick people, for blind people, for people grieving lost loved ones, and for people who were spiritually harassed, lost, and exhausted. It may be difficult in a town full of engineers, or maybe a church full of engineers, to think about this, you know, because we're not great at feelings, right? But that's what Jesus did. And we're going to have those types of feelings if we're going to be like Jesus. If we want to be like Jesus, and this is the emotion, the feeling that is most attributed to him, do you think we need to have it? I think so. If we want to be like Jesus, we must feel compassion. Secondly, compassion was shown toward the multitude and often specifically directed toward the disadvantaged and marginalized. You know, I was thinking through this, and I had to ask myself, did Jesus give the people he was compassionate to a litmus test? Did he make sure that they were deserving of his compassion? You know, if anybody could have done that, it would have been Jesus. But as you read the stories, you don't see a bit of that, do you? I was told a story recently. I don't know if you guys, a friend of mine does a little seminar that another guy that I know do a seminar on the eldership, and they'll often present case studies, and they'll break you in the group, and then you do, and I wasn't at this particular event, and the fellow didn't tell me about it. It was another friend of mine said that they weren't doing the one there, the group was doing it on their own, but they broke into this case study, and this one brother was in need. And in particular, he just couldn't maybe pay an electric bill or something of that nature. And they got into their group, and there was an elder in every group. And the first comment, what do you think the first comment was about what we should do in this case study? First comment was, well, I want to check his attendance record. What's missing? What was missing? The gut-twisting emotion for someone in need. That's what's missing. How about you start with that, and then you get to some of the other things? But first, have some compassion. Think about the poor individual. Put yourself in their shoes and how they must feel. Right? It was the same group that literally, and a fellow told me this just, I think it was Wednesday night. they had a sermon that basically talked about the sin of empathy, the sin of empathy. Does that strike you? It's kind of shocking. And after the sermon, at the end of the service, one of the young men got up to lead the closing prayer and prayed to God that they would not have empathy. Is that what Jesus did? When he looked at that multitude, did he say, well, let me see if they've done all the right things? Have they lived just right? Have they followed every one of my laws? Have they made good decisions in their lives? Do they believe exactly what I need them to believe? Do you think that's what Jesus was doing in those stories that we read? And were these mainstream individuals the ones that would fit in? Were they the ones that had it all together? Maybe were pulling themselves up by their bootstraps? Were they the ones that hadn't made mistakes? Or were they all devout followers of God? You guys can answer those questions, right? Now, what does that say about us? How should we be when we encounter people of this nature? And then here's the other thing, and this is really inherent in the definition of the word compassion, but compassion always led Jesus to act. And compassion isn't just a feeling that you feel deeply. Compassion takes that feeling and takes action. That's what it does. Compassion always leads to action. He didn't just feel sorry for the people he encountered. He didn't say just be warmed and filled and then go on his way. He didn't make sure that it didn't interrupt his schedule, his travel, or offend his sensibilities. In every single New Testament instance of splachnosomia, the compassion, the twisting guts inspire action. And so he feeds, he mends, he comforts, he teaches the starving, the sick, the sorrowful, and the spiritually confused. Compassion always results in positive action. It starts with a feeling in the gut, and it leads to action. That's what compassion is. So do you want to be like Jesus? Let's see if the emotion can start in the gut and lead to action. That's the example that Jesus gave us. From these examples, by the way, one thing that I think we can take some comfort in and rest assured in is that Jesus has compassion on us, just like he did the people that he walked the earth with. And so he has compassion on us when we are sick or diseased, or when we're grieved over the loss of loved ones that have passed, or when we're confused and in need of direction and guidance, or when we are mistreated. Likely, we're likely to be more compassionate if we've experienced these things ourselves. Okay, now let's look at some of the teachings of Jesus, and I just have a couple, three of these. You know, as Jesus taught his disciples, and particularly Peter, about the limits, or actually the lack of limits of forgiveness, he told a story about a servant who could not pay what he owed, and he said to his master, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you all." And then the master of the servants was moved with compassion, released him, and forgave him the debt. But the servant did not do similarly for those who owed him. So the master returns with a message. "You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Should you not also have had compassion on your fellow servant, just as I had pity on you?" You know, as recipients of compassion from God, we should have compassion on others. And that's really the story of the parable of the unforgiving servant, that we ought to have compassion on others as recipients of that compassion. You know, when a lawyer came to Jesus in an attempt to justify himself, he asked Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" And Jesus replied with the parable of the Good Samaritan. And what it was that distinguished the Good Samaritan from all the other religious individuals that passed by the man that fell among thieves and was left half dead? What was it that distinguished him? Well, when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. Did you notice that not only did he feel compassion, but it led him to do something like that none of the other religious people were doing, right? What does that tell you? Compassion is expected even to be extended to those that we don't know well. It's not just something that is reserved for those that you... Did the Samaritan know the one that had fallen among the thieves? No. And who was it that Jesus was saying was your neighbor? Okay, and then after we have come to what... After we've come to what we have come to call the prodigal son, took his inheritance and left his father and his family and spent his inheritance on riotous living, when he could stoop no lower, he returned to his father. And what was it that drove the father's response when he saw the prodigal son returning? His father saw him and what? Had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And of course, the father in the story is supposed to represent our Heavenly Father, who has a deep well of compassion for those who return to him. And then finally, I thought I would just circle back. So we've looked at Jesus' examples. We looked at some of his teaching. This idea of compassion is just embedded in the parables that we know so well. And then, but he starts his teaching with the Beatitudes on the Sermon on the Mount. And he says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." And this is a slightly different word. It's eleo, or something of that nature. To have mercy, to show kindness, but not simply possessed of pity, but actively compassionate. So both at the beginning and the end of Jesus' teaching ministry, he is teaching about compassion and mercy. So let's just make a few observations about this. You know, when Jesus... first of all, I think we should not expect God to have compassion and mercy on us if we do not extend it to others. It's a core of his teaching for us, that we ought to provide it to others if we are expecting it. When Jesus tells his famous parable, the Good Samaritan, it was the twisting guts for the beaten, half-dead stranger that propelled the heroic Samaritan to action. And that that compassion set him apart from the pious, religious villains of the story. The true followers of Jesus are set apart from the religious imposters by their genuine compassion toward others. Compassion should be felt toward all who are our neighbor. And who is that? Who is it that we're not going to consider neighbor enough to not extend compassion to? Should we make a list? Or should we just say we're to extend compassion to everyone? Is that not the moral of the story? Everyone that you encounter. And then in Jesus' parable of the prodigal son, it's again that splachnezomea that sends the father running for the horizon to embrace and kiss the son who had abandoned him. And the father has a deep well of compassion for those who return to him. In fact, I have my Bible open. I really wanted to preach a lesson from Exodus 34, 5, and 6, because, you know, when God is describing himself, Exodus 34, 5, and 6, do you remember the first word that he uses to describe himself? He's compassionate. It's no wonder that Jesus, who manifests the Father to us more clearly than anything, was likewise compassionate, because the Father is compassionate. He has a deep well of compassion for those that return to him. And from these teachings, I think we can clearly see the expectation Jesus has for his disciples. We should not expect compassion if we don't show it ourselves. We ought to have compassion on those around us, whether we know them or not, whether they look like us or not, whether they're different than us, whether they're upper middle income, right? Whether they're the same ethnicity, whether they're the same socioeconomic status, whether they talk different, whether they look different, these things don't matter. And your compassion can't be limited by them. And he's willing to be to compassionately receive us back if we return, having left the situation of being mired in sin. So these are fundamental characteristics of God as well as of Jesus. So I want to end here with just a call to compassion, and then the lesson will be yours. And I'll start back with those questions that we asked at the beginning. How well do you think Christians on the whole have done in terms of compassion? And then how about those with whom we would think of as having the closest fellowship with? How have we done? And then maybe just how have I and you done personally? Can we ask that question? How much attention have we been giving to compassion? I want to tell you something that really surprised me. As I was starting to think about this lesson a long time ago, I searched my favorite church websites. And we have these great search features where you can just go in and you type in the topic. So I type in compassion. What do you think I found? You guys guess. I couldn't find lessons on compassion. You know, I would look at, and these, I love the preachers at these places, by the way. They're great. I have tons of respect for them. But I'm looking over like periods of time, like 10 or 20 years of sermon recordings. And I'm finding like one or two lessons on compassion. You guys, tell me why that is. What's going on? Why is that the situation? I will say I found one church website, a bunch of people I just love to death, know really well. There were a lot on one site. I was so happy to see that. And maybe they're being kept under different names, but there's a dearth of preaching that's being done on the topic for some reason. I don't understand it. I think we're scared of it. And I had a little bit of fear and trepidation myself. Yeah, you know, I was afraid you guys might think I'm a big softy or something. No, I think we're afraid of the topic, frankly. You guys think that? Why are we afraid of the topic of compassion? I think we're afraid because we think that if you're compassionate, it means you think anything goes, that you have to accept. But what did Jesus do? What did Jesus do, guys? We don't have to be afraid of compassion, and we don't have to not talk about it. This, if we want to be like Jesus, we're going to have to show and be compassionate, and it's going to have to drive us to action. It's just a necessity. And I want to just say, I think sometimes we think about these things as sort of being what I'll call the corporate church responsibility, but it's our individual responsibility. We all need to take some ownership of this, and each one of us try to be compassionate. And I want to speak specifically about being compassionate towards our spiritual family, towards our brothers and sisters in Christ. And I'll just say, I think there's some people that it's really easy to be compassionate towards, just frankly. I could name them, but I don't want to embarrass them, but it's so easy to be compassionate for a lot of reasons. We just love them to death, you know? They're just, you know, there's so many reasons. But now here's the question. How about the ones that aren't so easy to be compassionate towards? How are you doing there, right? Just think about the people you might consider, like my friend that was on the fringes, that didn't quite fit in, didn't talk like everybody else. Frankly, he probably didn't dress like everybody else. I can guarantee it. He didn't speak like them. Probably when he made comments in Bible class, they weren't as polished or refined or well thought out. What about the people that are just on the fringes, but they're here among us? How about the people that are hurting? How about the ones that are suffering right here in our midst? Are we showing compassion to them, or are they sort of excused from our compassion circle because they don't really fit in? That's what I want you to think about. Sometimes do we see people as like an enemy rather than ideas? Or do sometimes we first think of how much time will be consumed on our part and therefore excuse our lack of compassion? You know, the best sermon I found one of my favorite sites had two lessons on compassion. One was by a preacher that is no longer with us and was probably more than 10 years ago. And the other was probably the best sermon I've heard on compassion from the most unpolished speaker. It was a fellow that had just finished cancer treatment. He wanted to thank the congregation for the compassion that they had, and he did a lesson around it. So what could we do differently this week if we set our mind toward being compassionate, more compassionate than we were last week? So just think for a second how compassionate you were last week and say, what could I do next week if I just want to be more compassionate than last week? So towards our spiritual family, let's make sure that we're showing compassion to everyone that's part of our spiritual family. I want you to imagine one of us maybe getting a letter from someone here that says, I'm at the end of my rope 5 years from now. And think what we could do today to maybe prevent that. Would that not be a good goal for us? You know, one thing I've tried to think about, even in the course of this lesson, and perhaps this is stepping on my own feet, but we often at our elders' meeting have a list of people that we're worried about. You know, we spend most of our time in the elders' meeting thinking about, talking about people. We usually try to do a great deal to reach out to them and so forth. But are we leaving the 99 to go get the one? You know, that's what we're called to do. Or do we just let the one get away? I think my friend, my brother, was a one that no one chased down. Are we leaving the 99? It's not just the elders' responsibility, though. Each one of us can do something. Can you think of one person or one couple that's left us over the last 5 years? Could we reach out to them, see how they're doing, tell them that we love them and that we're here to help? I can think of a number of people in that condition. And by the way, some of them, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to talk to them. It's a lot of work to be around them. It's not going to be like the most fun thing that you've ever done, but they're deserving of our compassion. What can we do? Do we have to wait till we get that letter that tells us that they're into their rope and their life is in shambles? What if God is planning to save that soul or rescue that marriage or mend that broken individual through you? What if that's his plan? What if that's exactly what he wants to do, is use you to do that? Through you first having that feeling of compassion that was characteristic of Jesus and then acting on it. Let's not follow the path of the Pharisees who were getting every particular right in their worship and in their ceremonial service to God, right? They were doing that, right? They were getting everything right, but missing the big stuff. And Jesus said to them in Matthew 23:23, echoes of Micah 6, which Nathan led us a song about. He said, "Woe to you scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe and mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy or compassion and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." Justice, mercy, and faith. Okay, how about this towards our physical family? How are we doing in terms of having compassion on our own family? Now, you're probably immediately thinking, oh, well, we do that well. But I don't know if that's really the case. Are we having compassion on those with whom we have the most contact? What do you know about your family? You know better than anybody all their faults, all their flaws, all the mistakes they've made. And you've probably heard it all before. Do you ever feel numb? This thing happened to me. I would say it's funny, but it may not have been. But I was going from Research Park on the 565, sort of heading home one day. This is years ago. I'm sure it wouldn't happen today. But as I drove on this road, I saw in my rearview mirror a police car. And it came over, and then it kept going over. I was like, I immediately looked at my speedometer. I was so happy because it was where it needed to be. And but then, and so he went over, and I said, oh, great. Then he came back. I said, you got to be kidding me. What's going on? And sure enough, he lit me up, and he stopped. I really had no idea. So he came, and he said, do you know why I pulled you over? I was like, no, I have no idea. But and he said, you know that little date sticker on the back of your license plate? It had the wrong, I didn't have, so I thought, oh, this is great, because I got my other one in the glove box. So I pulled out the glove box. By the way, just for you teenagers, when the cops come to you, hold both hands on the steering wheel. Don't look in the glove box before he gets there. Wait till him to tell you to, okay? I'm very careful about that stuff, you know. I don't know who taught that to me. But so after he was there, I said, I think I have in my glove box. Can I get over there and look, you know, look in? So I got it and I showed it. I was so happy. And he said, well, let me see your insurance too. You know, I must have had like a dozen of those little insurance cards. Not a single one with the current date. I was like, you got to be kidding. I'm not good at that stuff, frankly. But he told me, he said, okay, well, that's all fine, but you're going to have to go down to the courthouse on such and such a date and prove to them that you had insurance on the day I pulled you over. I was like, oh, great. You know, I feel like I'm busy and everything. So I go into this room, and I don't know, Butch or somebody may know this a lot better than I do. Not that he's been in this situation, but he's a federal judge. But I go in this room, there's like 50 people or something. And they're just calling us up one by one. And there was this officer standing up, very tall, you know, rigid, and then a lady that was sitting at the desk, the clerk or something. And so they would come up, and like she would read over the charges, and then the person would be in front of them, and then they would give them, like, I guess it was effectively their sentence. This is a little bit of a vague memory now, but I remember that, like, it was stuff like, I remember one was like someone had his car windows tinted and he needed to pay a fine. But if he couldn't pay the fine, he was going to have to go spend the night in jail or something. And I'll just tell you, every one of the people that came up, I got to tell you, I was like, my heart was breaking a little bit, because I was thinking, you just wanted to jump up and help him some way, right? And it felt terrible. And what I noticed, though, that was kind of surprising to me was that the officer and the clerk seemed totally like stony-faced and weren't feeling a thing. And I kept asking I was feeling so much different than they were. I kept asking myself, why is that? And it finally occurred to me that they probably see hundreds of these every day. They may have seen 2,000 or 2 million of these types of cases. And eventually, I think they just get numb. They get numb to it. That's a danger for us, I think. And it can particularly be a danger if you get numb and you no longer are compassionate towards those to whom you're the closest. And so don't fall into that trap of losing your ability to be compassionate because with that person that you're the closest to. All right, and then how about towards close associates? One of the occasions on which Jesus was said to feel compassion is when he saw the multitude, and they were like sheep without a shepherd. And what's he said to have done? He was said to have he taught them. Are we driven to teach by the deep-seated compassion, knowing that the individual is lost in sin? That should drive us. You know, I was reminded of an article that was sent to me a while ago, but it was about why Facebook can't change minds. And I thought the article was pretty insightful because it's, you know, it said the way to change people's minds is to become friends with them and bring them into your circle. Be compassionate first and then show them the way to God through both your actions and your words. You know, a lot of people are never converted to Christ because they see a lot of hypocrites in church buildings. They know that Christ was compassionate, but they don't see it in the Christians that profess to follow him. And then finally, how about those that that we encounter along the journey? How do you react to people that are poor and needy or even living on the streets? Do you immediately think how they deserve the condition they find themselves in because of their immoral behavior, bad choices, broken relationships, or alcohol and drug use? Who do you think, by the way, that Jesus would spend time with if he returned now to live among us in North Alabama for a few months? Where do you think he would go? Have you thought about that? You know, Jesus had compassion on those who were suffering, whether it was from physical ailments or the direct result of sin, regardless of where how they got where they are. Jesus saw people as created in the image of God and showed compassion on them, even the dirty, the flawed, the rebellious, the contagious, and the forgotten. When you see someone who is living with the consequences of their sin, does it make us cringe or cry? Is your heart moved to pray for that person's relief, healing, comfort, and salvation? Is your compassion strong enough to cause your hand to extend in action, in help, or in hope? That's what Jesus would do. You know, I was reminded of this story. All of you that are Star Wars fans, when I say Grand Inquisitor, what do you immediately think of? Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? The new series, and there's this Grand Inquisitor. There was a Grand Inquisitor before that during the Spanish Inquisition, and there was a famous author, Dostoevsky, who wrote this this novel called The Brothers Karamazov. I probably didn't say that right either. It's a Russian literature. I'm not a huge fan of Russian literature, but one of the chapters in that is what he calls a poem. It doesn't read quite like a poem, but he has Jesus returning during the Spanish Inquisition, where the church is searching for and killing those who are not true believers. And after he arrives, after Jesus arrives and performs miracles among the people, healing them, just like he did in New Testament times, by the way, he's rapidly imprisoned and indicted by the Grand Inquisitor, who chastises him for healing the people and giving them hope. The Grand Inquisitor goes on to explain why to Jesus why the church no longer needs him or his approach to saving people. And I kept asking myself, what if Jesus came among us? Would we say, we don't need that? That's not how we do things? What if he brought the homeless or the poor or the needy or the dirty in our midst? Would we be scandalized? How would you feel about that? What if instead of following our traditions, he spent time with the ones that needed him most? What if he ended up preaching in the prisons or under the overpasses instead of in this pulpit? Would we react the way the Grand Inquisitor did in the story? So finally, by way of invitation, I mentioned before that Jesus was pretty undiscriminating in terms of whom he had compassion, on whom he had compassion. And if you need evidence of that, his life and his death are evidence of it. Because Jesus had compassion on us while we were yet sinners, alienated from him. His coming in the flesh was an act of compassion. The author of Hebrews describes it this way in chapter 2, verse 17. It says, therefore, in all things he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful, compassionate, and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered, being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. Why did Jesus take on the form of man? So that he could be merciful or compassionate to us. And as a result, as we read in Hebrews chapter 4 and 15, Jesus can sympathize with our weaknesses, and we can therefore obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. He died for us and offers us grace, forgiveness of our sins. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, then with faith toward God, turn away from your sins and decide you're going to live a life dedicated to following Jesus and be buried with him in the waters of baptism so that you can rise to walk in a new life filled with compassion for others as you mirror the character of Jesus and of the Father. If you're subject to the invitation, won't you come as we stand and sing?